welcome to Juno Afternoon. I'm Shelley Delaney, and this week on the show, we're looking back at some of our favorite interviews of 2022. On today's episode, we'll hear a conversation between Rasha McChesney and members of the Tongan community in Juno about their reactions after the volcanic eruption in January. We'll also hear the memorable and meaningful discussion about the importance of accessibility of learning Alaska Native languages. Finally, we'll revisit some of the fascinating interview with Kristi Nami Erickson and author Juliana Hugh Pegues about the concept of space-time colonialism. Those conversations, sounds wild, music, and more coming up right here on Juno Afternoon. KTOO would like to acknowledge that we broadcast from the homelands of the Occoquan. The Hlinédi have stewarded this area for thousands of years. The tidelands where our studios sit are now covered over with buildings, roads, and parking lots, but they were once a source of food, a place to maintain smokehouses, and a place to gather driftwood for fuel. In sharing this history, KTOO hopes to honor the ancestors and the descendants of the Occoquan. We recognize those families who have never relinquished their ownership and stewardship of their land and waterways and continue to cherish and depend upon their immediate connection to the waterfront for today and for future generations. We'd also like to take a moment to say thank you to the individuals who helped us craft our daily land acknowledgement. Gunas Chish to Vera Starboard, who planted the idea of making it super place specific and guided us on pronunciation. Lillian Petershore, who created so much of the beautiful structure. Ishmael Hope, who gave additional ideas. And Ernestine Hayes, Bob Sam, and Fran Houston, who gave important feedback. We are grateful to all those offering guidance as we grow as an organization. You're listening to Juno Afternoon. I'm Shelley Delaney. This week, we're revisiting some of the most memorable interviews of the year. Our first interview goes back to January 18th, just 3 days after the shocking eruption of the Hunga Tonga Hunga Ha'apai volcano. Reporter Rasha McChesney sits down with members of the Tongan community in Juno to hear their reactions.
The Pacific island of Tonga has been isolated from the rest of the world after a volcanic eruption that triggered a tsunami that cut off phone and internet. Ash from that eruption has been a major problem, and there are concerns of it contaminating fresh water supplies. And one other complication with aid efforts is that Tonga is currently COVID-19 free. I'm Rasha McChesney. I'm here today with Melehoko Pau'u Ma'ake, Margaret Sakona, Stephen Paya, and Vika Paya. Thank you so much for having this conversation with me. You're all family and here in Juno. How's it going today? When was the last time that you heard from your family and friends in Tonga?
Vika, you want to answer that?
We're doing okay. We are still pretty much very concerned about our family and friends. We have not heard a single thing from anyone, and it's pretty devastating.
Some of the places where my mom come from, Ha'atafu, she has an auntie that they grew up there, has been completely damaged, and these are coastal area villages. And so we heard for sure that Ha'atafu severely damaged. And so that's the only information we've been able to get. So it's a good thing there is a High Commissioner of Australia and New Zealand there that has a satellite. Other than that, everyone's pretty much left in the dark, and we've been reaching out and no response whatsoever. And we're not the only one. Even people who lives in New Zealand, which is a lot closer to Tonga, it's the same thing, which I've been talking a lot to one of my first cousin because of her dad, who's 84, who's there. And still they haven't heard anything. And he's actually in the capital of in Nuku'alofa. So still no communication from him. So we're all, pretty edgy. to, you know, be able to hear from him that he's okay, and that he has a daughter that's also there, and they have a lot of little kids. So I want to turn some time over to Margaret and Stephen.
It's really scary. And, you know, Tonga is a really small country, but the people, everybody's really passionate and they love big. And so it's really important for us what's going on to kind of have people be aware and get involved in any way possible. But I have a little cousin that lives with us. He's been living with us for a couple of years now, but he moved from Tonga. And his dad and his sister are living there right now. And we speak to them every single week. But ever since the volcano erupted and everything went downhill over there in Tonga, we haven't been able to hear anything. We've been trying to call them, message them, and reach out to family and friends out there. But we haven't been able to get any kind of information except for what we've been able to read and see on the from the media. And it's a sad thing because sometimes we've even gotten misformed information too from the media. So I remember, like, my mom's village, the place where she's from, some people said it like completely sunk, but that was like, it was false. And so, like, for us right now, we're just like completely in the dark with everything, and that's just been, it's just been devastating all around. But that's the last we've been able to hear from family, is really just right before the volcano erupted.
Margaret, do you mind if I ask, it's been really tricky to get updates. Like, I've been checking, you know, news sources in New Zealand and Australia, and it seems like national, like international news was talking about it for a while, and then it just kind of went silent. And I'm curious, like, I've been checking sort of individual people's social media to see who might be posting. And I'm wondering how you're getting your updates, if you're sort of crawling family members' social media, if you're calling them, like, how are you trying to, like, make contact?
I've been literally going to any kind of source possible, like media. And then if I don't get enough from the media, then I've been having so many family and friends message me, send me information, like videos, pictures from other people's accounts. And so that's how I've been able to keep updated with what's going on. But still, even that kind of information is still not enough. And it's been really hard not hearing, being able to hear from anyone on the island. Because even like from New Zealand and Australia, we know that they've been, you know, waiting to kind of go in and help out. But because we've heard that it's still pretty active, the volcano, they're trying to be really cautious about going in anytime soon too. So. But yeah, that's how I've heard a lot of my information, is really from people's personal accounts.
Yeah, I want to clarify one thing. One thing that I've also noticed, because I've been doing the same thing, is going to many people's accounts. And to me, it seems like all those informations is from before. It was like from right before that eruption happened. You know, I can't sleep very well lately. And so that's because that's what I'm doing. I'm just, like, you know, trying to get any information, and look like every information that I'm getting, it's right before it happened. Just like my really good friend, when she did her video of driving home from when the during that eruption. So I kind of know how, you know, the land was looking like, and what with the water. And there was a video that got sent from Avika's auntie that we've just been sharing. I've been sharing around. And so, but it looked like all of that information was pretty much before, I mean, you know, yeah, before the internet went completely down in the phone and all of that.
Yeah, so I grew up in the islands in Tonga. And I moved here like right before my last year of in high school. So I kind of have an idea of what, you know, the life was when I, you know, when I grew up. So I can't imagine, you know, going through with what these kids and, you know, because 30% of, you know, the income that Tonga, the island of Tonga makes is from agriculture. And, you know, when I grew up over there, we always go to have our plantation. We always outside, like, majority of the time. The only time we're in the house, we go to sleep or you know, and then after that we go outside. So now I can't imagine, like, you know, your house is like 2 or 3 feet with water and you can't do anything, you know. So that's what I kind of, you know, thinking about is like what Mela said. We all we've seen of videos of what happened before the, you know, the tsunami. So this is very sad, you know. So I haven't heard from my sister, you know. And another thing too, we haven't talked about was when I grew up over in Tonga, we study the you know, what the islands are like in Tonga. And the main island is Tongatapu, where it's very flat. There's no no mountains. So and we always joke about it, there's a tsunami coming, it's gonna wipe out the whole islands. And there's about majority, I think it was like 70,000 live in that island. So I can't imagine 70,000 people with a tsunami warning cramped up in the little village that's trying to find the highest places.
I read that Tongatapu, like the highest point above sea level is like 76 feet or something like that. Like, it's just not a very, there's not a lot of high ground.
Yeah, that's why we're surprised that, you know, why is the whole, why, you know, the island is still an island, you know, it should have been underwater already, but that's what we're waiting to see. So
it sounds like you're saying it would be really difficult to be prepared for something at this scale.
One thing I noticed on the videos that I was being sent to is the awareness of volcano. What is a volcano eruption? What happens when a volcano erupts? I kept hearing, you know, the lady who was taking the video, like, why is it the rocks? Why is it raining rocks? Why is it the rain is dark? Why is there so much dust? I think that's like the number one thing that really blew me away was hearing, yeah, because these people have no idea. They have never experienced or even educated, or like here in America, you know, in the schools, we're taught like what you do in an earthquake, how you prepare, or, you know, you go under a table. There's not any kind of awareness.
I think it has more to do with they really didn't know that a volcano was erupting. Mm-hmm. So I'm sure they understand what volcanoes, but I don't think they had a warning like early on enough to be able to be prepared. Okay, there's a volcano about to erupt. You guys have to go to your safe spaces. You know what I mean? Because mm-hmm. I know, like, I always heard stories of my dad saying, like Benny was talking about, like they had tsunamis all the time. But mm-hmm. what some of them had to do was they would run to some of the church buildings, mm-hmm. and there was certain places, locations that they would have designated just for people to go to, because. Mm-hmm. I know that like a lot of homes are right next to the coastline and stuff. Mm-hmm. And so right. They would have to have other places to relocate. But I honestly feel like they didn't have a warning like sent to them saying like, hey, something's about to happen. You know what I mean? Cause then I would probably do the same. Like, what the heck are all the rocks falling from? Like, yeah. Cause I didn't, and it was underneath, the volcano was underwater. So I would be super confused if I didn't see a volcano.
And how are your friends and neighbors in Juneau helping you specifically? Like, what do you want them to know? And are they supporting you? And how can they support you in this going forward?
To me, it's the awareness that's really important with Tonga's situation. And I have amazing friends who are here from Juneau who's already, you know, who called me and checked up on me and my family to see if I had made any communication. So those are like the first questions that I'm getting, you know, from my friends here in Juneau, you know, so it's really nice, you know, to hear them, you know, that they care, that they, you know, that they know, because, you know, the Tongan, you know, like you kind of have a feeling, you know, feeling for it, Rasha. In our culture, in the Tongan culture, it's like, you know, it's almost like we're all, you know, we're all family and we're all in it together.
Actually, just yesterday, a really good friend of mine, all the way, she lives all the way in Florida. She reached out to me and asked me, She said, "Hey, how are your family? How's everyone doing?" And it kind of shocked me because I'm like, wow, even my friend who lives all the way in Florida, like she knows about this. And it's very comforting to know that people do care. And she reposted and shared a lot of things on the media. And that's something I think a lot of people can maybe continue to do, is just kind of share that with everyone else. That way everyone else is aware of what's going on. There are people who are going through a very hard time right now, and anything that, prayers, it doesn't have to be something, even just a prayer, saying a prayer or sending love and good light to others would be a great thing. Mm-hmm.
I agree with Vika and Mele. My input on this is, I want everyone to share. Most people don't know about, the islands and what's going on. And the more people, learn about it, they can help in any way. And not only that, I feel like my part, I don't know if you know my background, but I used to play professional football. And I'll be... be selfish of me if I don't reach out to my teammates and former teammates and coaches in this special organization. It's a billion-dollar organization. They help this kind of circumstances, especially for Tonga, and especially with so many Tongan Polynesian and NFL and other sports. I think that's going to be my side that I can help share the message, and I already told my wife that I don't mind going and help, because watching those videos, those kids in Tonga, and I have to, I can't imagine my kids, I can't imagine myself going up there, and going through that. So that's going to be my mission in the next year or two, to help out as much as I can, and just to spread those messages with everyone. It'll be selfish if you're Tongan and you don't get to help out, because you don't see anything, you don't get to experience anything in Tonga. But like Mele said, we're all families, and I'm already emotional just watching those videos, and I try to hide it from my wife this morning when she was watching, just looking at me when I was watching the videos. But I actually was teared up, because there's nowhere to hide in Tonga. If that tsunami come and wipe off the whole island, is like, where are you gonna go hide? So, but the damages after that for the next, 2, 5, 10 years is gonna be bad.
They're lucky to have you on their side, Stephen.
The one thing that I love about Tonga, and that's so beautiful about the country, is that they're a religious country. So if you're ever in Tonga, on a Sunday, that all businesses are closed down, and there's no businesses that are allowed to run on Sunday. That one day is everything is shut down. You're spending time at church or with family. Prayer is a big deal to us Tongan people. So if people can pray for us at this time, especially with not knowing where to, where we can send our resources and our, people wanting to help out in any way. I think the biggest help we could receive at this time is really praying, because like I said, religion and God is everything to us Tongans.
Mele Hoko, I think this is a good time for me to play that song that you sent me. Is there anything that you want people to know about that song before we jump right into it?
Yeah, actually that song go okuyai aki e okuyai aki fonua. It's a song about Tonga, and it's like almost the national
song of Tonga. Of course, we have our national song with our king, but this is a song that when you play this song, it talks about the little island, a little period that's so tiny that is in the ocean, and how us Tongan people, you know, what a blessing that we have that to, you know, grow up in such a beautiful little island, and we are very proud of it. We are very proud, very proud people, and we shall rise, and we will come together in this difficult time, and we will.
Mele Hoko, Vika, Stephen, Margaret, thank you so much for joining me and giving so much of yourselves today. I really appreciate it. And we will all be hoping and pulling for you that you'll hear from your friends and loved ones soon.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Rasha.
Thank you.
That was Rasha McChesney talking with members of the Tongan community on Juno Afternoon. The interview was recorded on January 18, 2022. Up next, we'll hear the meaningful discussion about the importance of making Alaska Native language classes free and accessible to all. I'm Shelley Delaney, and you're listening to the best of Juno Afternoon.
Sounds wild. Hi, I'm Riley Woodford for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. On a moonlit winter night on the Kenai, a snowshoe hare crouches low as it nibbles on a willow bush. Although its white coat renders it almost invisible in the snow, a great horned owl is about, and this owl loves to eat hares. She was hatched and fledged near Fairbanks a few years ago when hares were abundant there, but the hare population crashed in the interior, and she's come south to the Kenai, where hare numbers are still good. Every 10 years or so, the hare population in an area climbs to a peak and then dives off the cliff. It bottoms out for a couple of years, and then hare numbers begin increasing again. The causes for the hare crash are likely a combination of overbrowsing the food supply, predation, and disease. The hare cycle peaks in the north a year or two ahead of more southern areas. In interior Alaska, snowshoe hare populations peaked in 2019 and hit a low in 2022. In south central, hare populations peaked during 2020 and are near the low of their cycle in 2022. Hare numbers on the Kenai Peninsula, the YK Delta, and the lower Kuskokwim River are high in 2022, and the cycle is likely peaking with a crash coming. Sounds Wild, I'm Riley Woodford.
Hanson Grass, Ka eat with the shoe ye, we kashuk are ye tin. Jin katka ke jin tau kanakaya ha anikak, gunnil cheese.
This is Juno Afternoon. I'm Shelley Delaney. Our next interview was recorded this past June, right on the heels of celebration. Rhonda McBride and Claire Strimple talk with UAS Professor Hune Lance Twitchell and UAS Dean Corinne Silkatis about the university's efforts to offer free classes for anyone who wants to learn Tlingit, Hatkil, or Somaliyuk.
I was so happy to hear our languages at celebration and to see people gathering together, singing and dancing. One of our elders, his name is Cheotuish Herman Davis, and he likes to use this phrase, which is, it's echoing back to us. And it's just really a wonderful thought to think about someone who's in their late 80s, perhaps, and then has grown up watching a language get into increasing trouble and to decline, and then for him to be a witness to seeing it begin to shift directions, which is, I think, is what we've been witnessing over the past decade or more, is an increase in the number of speakers and an increase in the amount of use of the languages.
So, Karen, I'd like to go to you and just ask you to react, kind of coming in new to the job of dean in sciences in the midst of this sort of cultural renaissance. What's that like?
Goodness, sheesh. Thank you for inviting that question. As somebody new to Juneau and somebody new to Alaska, it's been a wonderful time of learning for me as dean of arts and sciences at UAS. And I'm grateful, I would say. I'm grateful to all of these wonderful people for teaching me about this wonderful place that I'm now calling my home and the people who have resided here for time immemorial. And I feel very grateful to live on this land of the Akwan. And I've told Hune that I will be taking beginning Tlingit this fall. I'm signing up for one of these classes that we're going to be talking about very shortly. And I'm really excited to start my own journey learning an Alaska Native language. And one of the things that really struck me, and I attended everything, it's a celebration, and just being enveloped by knowledge bearers, by culture bearers, and witnessing for myself the beautiful generosity that was shared with me. I felt very included. I felt very welcomed. I felt very grateful is how I felt. And I as somebody who's learned languages throughout my life, right? And the language I know best is Spanish. And if somebody would have said to me, there are only a couple of Spanish speakers left, and that's it, Spanish is dying, I can't even comprehend what that would be like for me. As people in my own family speak Spanish as as their language, right, or Portuguese, and I have family who are from Portugal, I can't even imagine what that would be like for me, what that would feel like for me. And now to come to Alaska and have people say to me, there are only a few birth speakers left. So this has been so important to me to learn and listen to Hune. And how important this is for us, language revitalization.
And to have a course that anyone can take free of charge, that's amazing.
Yeah. Can you guys talk about how that came together? What's this course going to be like?
Yeah.
Sure. I'm actually going to give that to Hune because it was his dream. This has been his dream for a long time.
Sheesh. Well, I guess there's history here. So going back to Chancellor John Pugh, and he talked to me about this idea of a MOOC, like a massive open online course. And he said, what if we tried something like that? And we talked about it, and then through a partnership with Outer Coast and Sitka and Sea Alaska Heritage Institute, we ran one, like actually year one of the pandemic. And we just tried it, and we put the word out, and we had over 600 people sign up and want to take it. And the largest class we had was 150, and it just kind of was mind-blowing to think, well, we might have fewer than 40 speakers left, but we've got 150 people walking in the door. And then Chancellor Rick Caulfield we talked about a zero credit option, saying, well, what if people didn't want the college credit? And then when we put that through, there was still a small fee associated with it. And then we just kept talking. We kept saying, Indigenous peoples did not choose to be in this situation. We didn't put ourselves in this situation. Our language was banished. It was prohibited. It was made illegal. We were tortured and abused and all kinds of things to get us to stop speaking. So why should we have to pay to learn our own language, especially if we're finding effective ways to really get people started to become a speaker? And so under the leadership of Chancellor Karen Carey and Dean Karen Silkaitis, I just kept saying, what's it going to take? Where are we going to – just give me a number. Give me an idea, and let's just get rid of all the money. So we just say, what if we just took the doors off the Klan house and just let people walk in? And I want to give a lot of credit to Sea Alaska Heritage Institute, to Rosita Worrell and to Lee Cadinger, who just kept saying, no, we got to take it off. No minimal fees, no anything. So folks can sign up for a zero credit option. And it's important to know, like, if you just want to learn the language, you don't have to pay. And we're going to figure out what that looks like in terms of numbers of people who are all learning at the same time. We might overwhelm ourselves, but it's a way to get, I think, to a safer spot. But we do offer certificates and degree options, which is going to include down the road a Master of Arts in Teaching Indigenous Languages. And so this zero credit option might not always apply to those things. So just make sure if you're interested in learning, you know which kind of – are you going to take the four-credit path or the non-credit path? And then we're just really excited to see what it's going to happen. I think it's going to be medicinal. I think it's going to be it's going to alter the course of the way things are going, and it's really exciting.
So when does it start, and have people started signing up? Do you have to?
Well, it starts in the fall. So if you look up on the UAS website for courses, you have – these are – they're called AKL is what you would look for in the course, and those are our language courses. And then there's a zero credit option, which is AKLA. So they'll be taught at the same time. So you'll be in the same class as folks who are getting the credit, but you won't receive a grade. And also for some people, it's so intimidating to come in and to learn an Indigenous language. There's a lot of trauma involved with that. There's a lot of fear involved with that. So for some people, they might feel better if they didn't have a grade. But some of the things that we're going to sort of work with folks on is what does it mean to be at certain levels as speakers, and how do we help people continue to progress? And really pushing back on, for a while there was kind of this idea floating around that if people didn't pay for it, they wouldn't value it. But I think that's an untested theory, and I think that comes from some things that are outside of the way that we typically want to do things, which is to make it available, to make it safe to learn, safe to speak, and also to engage in conversations of what does it mean to learn and use an Indigenous language? What does it mean to bring it back to daily use? And sometimes there's going to be some bumps in the road. There's going to be some people that are upset, but we're going to really try and engage in a lot of conversations around those things that are creating those feelings and see what we can do to keep folks at ease, to keep it fun, even though it's challenging, and to keep people going.
Has this been done before? Is this a potential model for other places and other universities?
I think it is. I think it is a great model. I think that we are modeling access. And part of my, you know, when you think about diversity or equity and inclusion work, I think people forget the word, access in DEI work. And I think access is a key component to your sort of overall inclusion and equity strategy. And you have to create access. You have to open doors. You have to bring seats to tables. And I think the way to do that is to create more access. And I think creating free curriculum is a way to create more access for people. And to answer your question about people signing up, I have received some great emails already. There is a young woman who emailed me yesterday from the Lower 48 who said, I just want to let you know, I want to thank you. I'm signing up for a non-credit course to learn a language that my grandmother spoke.
Wow. So can you guys tell me why now? Where are we in this moment of you've been building language access and language learning for a long time. Why this moment for this to happen, and what's coming next?
Yeah, well, I think if you're on the side of languages that are really trying to keep them at a safe space and bring them to a safe space, I think you're always looking for what comes next, because we just had a language gathering this week, and I would say there's probably fewer than 10 master level BRRRR speakers who can do kind of all of the things in Tlingit, and then they can translate anything and they could say anything. And so just knowing the realities of our language continuing to go through a decline, we're trying to brace ourselves for this time when a lot of our elders, we've been watching them leave us and have been very scared about what happens next. And so for me, it's trying to sort of figure out what's going to be the series of things that we can put in motion that'll get us to a point where we don't know everybody who can speak Tlingit, where we just hear it more in the grocery stores, in the post office, in the community, walking around, and that it would be more common for us to hear it. So until our languages are in a safe space, we're going to continue to think of what the next moves can be. And some of those moves are, you know, as we put kids through education, how do we make sure that they continue to have people who will challenge them in their language learning journeys? And some of that is going to be just continuing to analyze how education works, because education was a vehicle of oppression and genocide and assimilation. So our goal is to transform it into a vehicle of opportunity and equity and healing, which is, it's not easy to do because not everybody sees things the same way. We'll be offering Tlingit, we'll be offering Smelgech, the Tsimshian language, and we'll be offering Khatkil, the Haida language. So all three languages of Southeast Alaska. We are in talks with folks about the Eyak language and seeing if we can include that language in our programming, and I'm hoping that we're able to build that in the near future.
And so this isn't the only update. I think there's some changes on the teaching side as well. What else is coming in the language department?
We're going to propose a Master of Arts in Teaching Alaska Native Languages. I'm in talks with folks at the Department of Education and Early Childhood Development to say, is there a future in Alaska where every student who graduates high school takes at least one semester of an Alaska Native language? And then are there ways to ensure that every school in Alaska has an Alaska Native language teacher? And so again, one of the things that we're trying to do is to not be some optional thing or some thing that's sort of not part of the main source of the curriculum. Like if there's a curriculum that exists and that there's standards, then I think Indigenous peoples and their languages should be part of those standards. And so, again, you just keep knocking on the door until it starts to resemble equity. And it's moving in that direction. It's still a long ways off, but it is going that way.
I agree with everything that Chene said. And I'm also, I think as dean, one of my main jobs is to support faculty. And I think what I've been able to do this year is find ways to say yes. I think, you know, one of the first times you interviewed me, you asked me about being a theater artist in Chicago and what I can bring to this equation. And one of the things I can bring is one of our deep traditions in Chicago is a yes and mentality. And I've been able to do that this year as a good partner and team player to Hune, is to say yes and what's next, right? And I feel like that's how I've been able to help.
Kuni, you brought up the idea of how a language thinks, and I hate to put you on the spot, but do you have a word or a phrase that you could tell us about that's one of your favorite ways of the language thinking? Or,
well, we talk about some things like an elder once told me, "Gen has ausane ach gentu adiye," like they've already prepared this path for us, and so it was really comforting because a lot of the work that we're trying to do. We get intimidated and we get worried. But then if they start telling us things like that, it feels like we're sort of doing this thing that our ancestors have prepared us for and have prepared. And then another neat one, I think, goes to Kahtakawuhin, which is the name of a school in Juneau that used to have another name. And as we sort of start transitioning to using Tlingit names and then restoring Tlingit names, it opens the door for thinking about some things differently. So in Tlingit, calm, still water is very linked to peace and calmness. And rough and turbulent water is linked to war and chaos. And so if you took some water out of a river that runs from a glacier and you put it in a clear container and just set it on a table, you'd see all this murkiness in it, the silt and everything else. And if you just left it there long enough for the particles to settle, it'd say, Yahin kau daku, the water has settled clear. And then there's a phrase linked to that, which is, let your mind and your spirit and your feelings be like water that has settled clear. And so for me, those things are important, because sometimes in doing language work, you get some pushback. Some of that, a lot of that pushback is fueled by racism, but some of that pushback is fueled by fear and other things, control. But then as you sort of learn these phrases that help keep you at peace, it really helps you to spread this idea that we can do this, we should do this, and we can do this together.
Thank you. Do you think that when you have more and more people having access to the language, that you kind of reach this saturation point that you need to really give the language a boost? And do you think that these classes, which people can take online for free, might do that?
I think it's a step. And I think we'll always continually be looking for more shifts. Like, could a restaurant in Juneau say, we're giving 10% discounts for Tlingit speakers tonight, and we're hoping our restaurant is all in Tlingit tonight? Or can I order coffee in Tlingit? Can I use my Tlingit name when I go order food? And can, you know, there's, I remember I used to go to one checkout at a grocery store. There was one person I always looked for who was running the cash register, because she spoke Tlingit and I could talk to her in Tlingit while I was checking out for my groceries. And so I think it's going to reach a point where we'll look back, where we'll say, you remember how rare it was when we didn't speak to hear Tlingit? You remember when hardly anybody knew Tlingit? And then I think my hope is we look back at that and say, what a strange time that was. And I'm glad that we're in a different moment. So I think it's going to contribute to it. And I think there's a number of other things that are going to happen at the same time.
That was Rhonda McBride, Claire Strimple, Rene Lance Twitchell, and Corinne Silkatis. The interview was recorded on June 22, 2022. When we come back, you'll hear a fascinating discussion about the concept of space-time colonialism. I'm Shelley Delaney, and you're listening to the Best of Juno Afternoon.
One night in the moonlight above, I found heart was the sea. One night in the moonlight above, I found you in dreams, were swimming and free. That time, the time in the stars, stars in the sky, fell full of
Support for Juno Afternoon comes from Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, providing Juno with locally roasted coffee for over 40 years, with cafes and drive-through locations throughout Juno. More at heritagecoffee.com.
I'm Shelley Delaney, and this week we're revisiting some of our favorite interviews from 2022. Up next, my interview with Kristi Nami Erickson, owner of Kindred Post, and author Juliana Hugh Pegues. Pegues recently published a book that explores the interconnections between Indigenous land dispossession and Asian labor exploitation in Alaska. Juliana, would you please introduce yourself to our listeners?
Sure. My name is Juliana Hugh Pegues. I can introduce myself two ways. And one is I went to Ok Bay School, Foy Dryden, and I'm a JDHS graduate class of 1987. That's one way I can introduce myself. And then the other way I can introduce myself is that, or maybe three ways, is that I'm an associate professor at Cornell University in the Department of Literatures and English. And I also teach in the American Indian and Indigenous Studies program and in the Asian American Studies program. And maybe the third way is to greet folks listening in Kleinaidi homelands and to say hello to you from both where I work and teach Kaikono homelands in Ithaca, New York. And today I am phoning in from Dakota homelands in Minneapolis, Minnesota.
Gunashish, I love all of those introductions. That may be one of the best intros I've ever heard. Because we all have these multiple identities, right? Mm-hmm. So let's talk about your book, which is titled Space-Time Colonialism, Alaska's Indigenous and Asian Entanglements. There's a lot to discuss right there in the title, which is awesome. So for starters, can you tell me what you mean by space-time colonialism?
Well, one, I have to take you to, I think, a cloudy, I don't think a rainy, maybe a cloudy, maybe sunny afternoon in Kristi Nami Erickson's living room and saying, I am really bad at titles, Kristi, can you help me? And Christy's like, let's brainstorm. I'm really good at this. I'm an artist. I'm an organizer. I'm really good. Let's make like an idea board. And then I can talk about what the title sort of means. But I said, I'm thinking about, you know, already I had the ideas of space and time, and I can talk about that more in a little bit. But I was like, I need something that is not sort of overly academic, overly jargony, something that both captures the book, but is, but also sort of maybe captures my nerdy self. So we sort of just worked with the ideas of space, time, land, labor, Asian, Indigenous, like we're kind of, you know, thinking about all kinds of things. And space, Kristi was like, what does this make you think of? What are other words, right? So really great at kind of, and the poet, I think, and Kristi was like, let's spin on this a little bit. Let's take jumps with the ideas. And I was thinking about the space-time continuum, like it sort of went to a nerdy place. And that's where we landed, I think, on this idea of space-time colonialism as a title.
Kristi, is that how you remember this happening?
Maybe not.
Let's get your side of the story.
Like, I'm really good at this. In fact, I think it was more like, don't ask me this because now I won't be able to unthink about it. This is what we're doing now. This is what we're going to
do
all afternoon now.
No, it's a great title. Well, let's talk a little bit about the book, the research. How'd you get into this area, Juliana? What made you want to write this book?
Well, as an Asian American, I was born in Taipei, Taiwan. My mom is Chinese and my dad's white. And my dad is the fourth generation white settler in Alaska. And growing up in Juneau, it's deeply personal interest. And when I was in graduate school, originally the kernel was to think about Asian American history in Alaska. Just that was sort of the basic idea, which really hasn't been done or written. And it became obvious really quickly that one, I couldn't even do that piece of it without sort of understanding Alaska Native lands, peoples, and knowledges. And from even the basics of Alaska Native communities, hold so much memory and history of Asian immigrants well beyond what's in the official archive. When I was first starting out talking to people, that alone was really clear. And then it became sort of, I don't think I can do this project if I don't kind of think about indigeneity and racialized immigration in the same frame. Like that's just how this has to be done. And from there, then I had sort of a responsibility not only to sort of study Asian American studies, but also American Indian and Indigenous studies. And then, you know, when you're in Alaska, Southeast Alaska, as you start to do the research, I talk to people, I am an extrovert, and I would hear more stories. So this is sort of how the book sort of expanded in ways that some of the stories that I ground in the book, such as China Joe, I've heard all my life. And other stories such as, and histories such as the Japanese immigrant photographer Shoki Kayamori, who lived in Yakutat for 30 years. That was a story that came to me from people talking and saying, you really should look at this, right? And then looking at his photographs and delving deeper into his history. And then in terms of, this is the joy, because this project is historical, but it also looks at cultural production. And I got to pick some of my favorite works. So to also then look at Ernestine Hayes's first memoir, Blonde Indian, and Nora Marks Gunhauer's poetry. So to actually sort of flesh this out also with Alaska Native authors and artists.
Can you say more about the term cultural production and why it's important?
Yeah. Yeah, sure. And I like cultural, you could say art, but I think cultural production is important to me because it is both a labor and an economy. And I also think that there are cultural producers, right? Cultural workers. And so for me, it's important we can use art. And I also think that art sometimes has highbrow and elitist connotations, which are fine too, to assert that Alaska Native artists and Asian immigrant artists are also important artists in their own right. I have no problem with that. But I think cultural production for me is a more useful term in thinking through the connection to communities, to thinking more expansively and holistically to work in economies and importance, that it's actually part of how a community survives, that it's sustenance in a particular way that is as important as sort of the subsistence of sustenance that we think of.
Sorry, you did not call on me, but I just have to chime in and say how good that was. That was so good. And I love that framing around artists as cultural producers, as community workers, as laborers in the cultural and community economy. So thanks for saying all of that, Juliana.
Of course.
What was your process for doing this research and then for organizing it, for piecing it together into a book?
Good question. I always think of it for the writers out there. It's like moving from the one page poem to an epic poem. At a certain point, you can't hold it all in your brain. It's moving to that scale of a project. So, you know, it started with what I wanted to look at, both in terms of cultural work and cultural production and sort of the sort of lines of inquiry in terms of histories that I wanted to sort of follow. But I have a particular way of trying to think of, if I were to write a novel, it'd be very sort of like, oh, this chapter goes to a different character. Like, it's, if we think about that analogy. So I look at sort of stories and I try to go deep, but I also, when I run into sort of absences in the archive, or what I call sort of elisions, right? So not only when Native or Asian people are missing, but also when their stories are diminished or minimized, when I hit sort of those blocks when I was researching the histories, I would try to go to art and, you know, go to authors. In the case of, say, Shoki Kayamori, he left, at this point, over nearly 950 photographs have been found or and restored, but he left no written record. So all we have are the photographs, right? And so that you have this rich, really what we call a rich sort of visual and artistic archive of his life and the life of a community over 30 years, including like really intimate photos of Alaska Native brotherhood and sisterhood. One of Don Bremner, who is a Yakutat Tlingit resident, who father was a close friend of Kayamori, says, you know, he was actually part of the Alaska Native Brotherhood. He couldn't take these kinds of pictures if he wasn't part of this. And to see these deep, intimate photographs, but there's nothing sort of in the official archive, right, in the history on this man. And so to actually sort of look at the work. And so my process in some ways was circuitous, sort of meandering at times, but sort of always trying to follow how can I start to make connections even when it appears that the connections aren't there or they're absent in the way that we normally tell histories?
Which circles back to what you're describing about, you know, the way the present is being created as well, right? Is not being, the present is not being written just by institutions who publish or by policies, public policies in the government. It's being written right now by cultural producers and people on the ground who are living this life today.
Mm-hmm. In addition to all that's inside the book, the artwork on the cover is also pretty special. Mm-hmm. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, I am so lucky, blessed, honored. Crystal Worrell did an original piece for the cover of the book. And I'm sure folks are very familiar with Crystal as an artist and her work in Juneau. Tlingit Athabascan Yupik artist also has Russian and Filipino ancestry, which I think is important. And I had seen an older piece that Crystal had done from years ago that was really striking and looks similar in form and shape, but really different too. And Crystal was sort of like, that was a different time. I was a different artist. I want to make, and it's time for me to redo this piece. And I can describe it for folks, but it's the, and I apologies to Crystal and other artists who work in form line, but it is the salmon trout head, the ovoid, the sort of the foundational shape of form line, the salmon trout head. And it is that shape repeating, and sort of for me, how I look at it is it looks like the salmon trout heads are sort of falling on the page and sort of collecting at the bottom. There's movement on the page. And that's overlaid on top of a newspaper collage. And she asked, you know, at one point, do I need to find historical newspaper pieces, or can I use the present moment? Because so much is happening in the world that is not good. And I would love to chop that up, right? And use it as the collage and the background. Is that okay with you? And I said that was great. And to me, that has sort of another meaning about sort of the historical present. And then I think lastly with the newspaper, again, as I was saying, like in our discussion, as cultural production, right? Mm-hmm. Sort of the official record in newspapers has been sort of repurposed and no longer sort of legible in that same way, but is repurposed as the background in which sort of native form line predominate.
That conversation was recorded on August 5th, 2022. This wraps up today's show. Thanks for tuning in. Please join us again tomorrow for another special here on KTOO at 3:00. Juneau Afternoon will be on a break next week, but we will return with live shows on Wednesday, January 11th. For more information or to look back on other past episodes or to be on the show yourself, visit our website at ktoo.org/JunoAfternoon. And until tomorrow, have a great Juneau evening. Thank you.